Chapter 69. Ronnie Pye called early the following morning. With him came Dennis Peterson, and both of them were wearing suits. "Very fancy turnout," Sean greeted them. "Business or social?" "Well, you might say a little of each." Ronnie paused at the top of the veranda steps. "May we come in?" Sean led them to the end of the veranda, and they seated themselves before anyone spoke again. "I heard about the fire, Sean. Terrible business. I heard there was a native killed and both Dirk and Michael were hurt." "Terrible business." Ronnie shook his head in sympathy. "Did you also hear that I lost 4,000 acres of timber?" Sean inquired politely. "Yep, heard that also," Ronnie nodded solemnly. "Terrible business." Ronnie and Dennis glanced at each other furtively and then looked down at their hands. "Very nasty," Ronnie repeated, and a silence fell upon them. "Anything else worrying you?" Sean inquired politely. "Well, now that you've brought it up..." Ronnie reached inside his jacket and withdrew a long, folded document tied with a red ribbon. "Mind you, we don't have to discuss it today. Leave it until you feel better." "Talk," Sean grunted. "Clause 8," Ronnie spread the document between the coffee cups on the table. "In the event of the said security, namely a certain block of wattle known as Number 2, Block of Lion Cop Estates, in extent approximately..." Ronnie hesitated. "I guess there's no sense in me reading it all. You know what it says. The wattle was part of the collateral for the loan." "How long will you give me to raise the money?" Sean asked. "Well, Sean, you understand there's no period of grace allowed in the contract. Seems to me you'll have to put it up right away." "I want a month," Sean told him. "A month?" Ronnie was shocked and hurt by the request. "See here now, Sean, I don't honestly... I mean, surely you've got the money. I mean, why do you need a month? Just let us have your check." "You know damn well I haven't got it." "Seems to me," Ronnie offered delicately, "seems to me if you haven't got it now, there's not much chance you'll have it in a month." "Well, no offence, Sean, but we have to look at this thing from a business angle, if you follow me." "I follow you," Sean nodded, "and I want a month." "Give it to him," blurted Dennis Peterson, his first contribution. And Ronnie turned on him instantly with his face twisting into a snarl. The struggle he had had within himself to smooth out his features and to restore his voice to its level and reasonable tone lasted fully 5 seconds. "Well now, Dennis," he murmured, "that's an unusual way to look at it. Seems to me... I spoke to Audrey before we came up here. I promised her. Anyway, we both agreed." Dennis was staring out across the valley, unable to meet his partner's eyes. Suddenly Ronnie Pye chuckled. "Yes, by God. It would be even better that way, watching this big arrogant bastard crawling round begging with his hat in his hands. Sean would go to Jackson first, and Ronnie had telegraphed Jackson the previous afternoon. He had also telegraphed Nichols at the Standard Bank. By now the message would be spreading swiftly along the network of South African banking channels. Sean Courtney would find it difficult to borrow the price of a meal. "All right then, Sean. As a special concession, you can have a month." Then all the laughter was gone, and he leaned forward in his chair. "You've got exactly 30 days. Then, by Christ, I'm going to sell out under you." After they were gone, Sean sat alone on the wide veranda. The sunlight on the hills was bright and hot, but in the shade it was cool. He heard Ada's girls chattering somewhere in the house. Then one of them giggled shrilly. The sound irritated Sean. His frown deepened, and he drew a rumpled envelope from his jacket pocket and smoothed it out on the arm of his chair. A while he sat in thought, nibbling the stub of a pencil. Then he wrote, "Jackson, Natal Wattle," and again, "Standard Bank." Then he wrote, "Ben Goldberg." He paused and considered this last name on his list. Then he grunted aloud and scratched it out with 2 hard strokes of the pencil. "Not from the Goldbergs. Leave them out of this." He wrote again quickly, scrawling a single word, "Candy," and below it, "Tim Curtis." That was all. John Aitchison was in England. It would take 2 months to receive a reply from him. That was all. He sighed softly and folded the envelope into his pocket, Then he lit a cheroot, sank down in the chair, and placed his feet on the low veranda wall in front of him. "I'll leave on tomorrow morning's train," he thought. The windows behind him were open. Lying beyond them in the bedroom, Michael Courtney had heard every word of their conversation. Now he stood up painfully from the bed and began to dress. He went out the back way, and nobody saw him leave. His mare was in the stables, and on a borrowed saddle he rode back to Tunis Kral. Anna saw him coming and ran out into the yard to meet him.
"Michael! Oh, Michael, thank God you're safe! We heard—"
Then she saw his face, and the raw, swollen burns on it, and she froze. Michael dismounted slowly, and one of the grooms led his horse away.
"Michael, darling, your poor face!"
And she embraced him quickly. "It's nothing, mother."
"Nothing?"
She pulled away from him, lips drawn into a tight, hard line.
"You run away in the middle of the night to that... Then you come home days later with your face and your hands in a terrible mess. Is that nothing?"
"I'm sorry, mother. Grandma looked after me."
"You knew I'd be half dead with worry, sitting here imagining all sorts of things. You didn't send word to me, you just left me."
"You could have come to the Lion Kop," he said softly.
"To the home of that monster? Never."
And Michael looked away from her. "Where's father?"
"In his study, as usual."
"Oh, darling, you don't know how I've missed you."
"Tell me you love me, Michael."
"I love you," he repeated automatically, and the sensation of suffocating was on him again. "I must see Dad. It's very urgent."
"But you've just arrived. Let me fix something to eat. Let me see to your poor face."
"I have to see Dad now. I'm sorry." And he went past her towards the house. Gary was sitting at his desk when Michael walked into the study. Michael hated this room. He hated the high, smoke-stained ceiling, the oppressive darkness of the panelled walls, the massive hunting trophies. He hated even the carpets and the smell of old paper and dust. From this room had issued the decrees and the pronouncements which had restricted and predetermined his life. This room was the symbol of everything from which he wished to escape. Now he glared around it defiantly, as though it were a living thing. "I've come back to extract from you what you owe me," he thought. "You've had value from me, now pay me back."
"Michael!"
Garrick's boot scraped on the wooden floor as he stood to greet him, and Michael winced at the sound.
"Hello, Dad. Your mother and I, we've been so worried. Why didn't you send word to us?"
The hurt was there in Garrick's voice. Michael opened his mouth to apologize in automatic guilt, but the words came out differently from the way he had intended.
"I was busy. I didn't have a chance."
"Sit down, my boy." Garrick gestured to one of the polished leather armchairs. He removed the metal-framed spectacles from his nose, but he did not look at Michael's injured face again. He would not think about Sean and Michael together.
"I'm glad you've come back. I was just working on the opening chapters of my new book. It's a history of our family from the time of your great-great-grandfather's arrival at the Cape. I'd very much like your opinion. I'd value it immensely."
The considered opinion of a graduate from the South African College. The trap was closing. It was so obvious that Michael squirmed. He could almost feel the panelled walls moving in on him. He started to protest.
"Dad, I have to speak to you."
But already Garrick was adjusting his spectacles and shuffling through the papers on his desk, talking quickly.
"I think you will like it. It should interest you."
Garrick glanced up and smiled at Michael with the eagerness of a child that brings a gift. "Here we are. I'll start at the beginning. You must allow for it being the first rough draft. It's not polished yet." And he began to read. At the end of each paragraph, he searched for Michael's approval, smiling in anticipation of it, until Michael could bear it no longer, until he shouted suddenly in the middle of a sentence,
"I want you to pay me out my share of Tunis Kral."
There was a momentary break in Garrick's reading, just a flutter in his voice to acknowledge Michael's request, and then he went on steadily. But his voice had lost its timbre and was now a lifeless monotone. He finished the paragraph, laid the sheet aside, removed his spectacles, and placed them in their case. The lid of the case snapped shut against the tension of its spring, and Gary lifted his head slowly.
"Why?"
"I need the money."
"What for?"
"I need it." Gary stood up and moved across to the window. He stood before it with his hand clasped behind him. The green lawns flowed down to the fence that bounded the gardens,
and upon them the poinsettia bushes were vivid patches of scarlet. Beyond, the land lifted into the first long roll, golden grass, and scattered forest, with the cattle feeding beneath, and the massive silver and blue clouds piled above.
"It will rain tonight," Garrick murmured, but Michael did not answer. "We need it. 3 weeks of dry, and the pasture is withering."
Still no reply, and Gary returned to his desk.
"I hear there was a fire on Lion Kop last night."
"There was."
"They say your uncle is finished. They say the fire finished him."
"No,"
Michael denied it quickly. "That's not true."
"Is that why you want the money, Michael?"
"Yes.
You want to give it to Sean."
"I want to buy a share in Lion Kop Wattle.
I don't want to give anything. It will be a business offer."
"And what about Tunis Kraal? It's your home. You were born here."
"Please, Dad, I've made up my mind."
"Did Sean suggest this?"
"He did not. He knows nothing about it."
"It's your idea, then.
You thought it up all on your own. You're going to sell out on your own parents for him.
My God, what sort of hold has he over you that you would do that for him?"
Flushing a dusty brick colour, Michael kicked back his chair and jumped to his feet.
"You make it sound like treachery."
"That's exactly what it is," shouted Garrick. "It's Judas's work. Your mother and I, we raised you with everything. We scraped to send you to university. We built our whole lives around you. We worked for the day you would return here to Tunis Kraal, and..."
He stopped, panting, and wiped from his chin the bubble of saliva that had burst through his lips.
"Instead, you ran off to join that swine. How do you think we like that? Don't you think it nearly broke our hearts? Of all people, you had to go to him. And now you want half of Tunis Kraal to take him as a gift, to buy his..."
"Stop that,"
Michael warned him sharply.
"And before you go on, remember where I got my half of Tunis Kraal. Remember who made the original gift."
He picked up his hat and riding crop and strode towards the door.
"Michael!"
The terrible appeal in Gary's voice checked him.
"What is it?"
"Your share.
It isn't very much. I hadn't told you before, but there was a time when you were very young. The Rinderpest. I had to..."
He couldn't go on.
"What are you trying to tell me?"
"Sit down, Michael.
Sit down and I'll show you."
Reluctantly, afraid of what he was about to hear, Michael returned and stood beside his chair. Gary selected a key from the bunch on his watch chain and opened the top drawer of his desk. He selected a rolled document, slipped it from its retaining ribbon, and handed it without speaking to his son. Michael spread it and read the words upon the cover.
"Deed of mortgage."
With a sliding sensation in his stomach, he turned the page. He did not read it all. Words and groups of words stood out in bolder print, and they were sufficient. "The Ladyburg Trust and Banking Co., a certain piece of land in extent approximately 25,000 Morgan, situated in the district of Ladyburg, Magisterial Division of Peter Maritzburg, known as the Farm Tunis Kraal. All constructions, erections, and improvements there, plus interest at 8.5%.
"I see."
Michael handed the document back to his father and stood up.
"Where are you going?"
"Back to Lion Kop."
"No," Gary whispered. "No, Michael, please, my son, no. Oh, God, no!"
Michael left the room and closed the door softly behind him. When Anna came into the room, Gary was sitting behind the desk, sitting quietly, with his shoulders slumped forward.
"You let him go," she hissed.
Gary did not move. He did not seem to hear.
"He's gone. Gone to your brother. And you let him."
Her voice was very low, but now it rose harshly, and she shrieked at him.
"You useless, drunken animal, sitting here playing with your little books. You were not man enough to breed him. Your brother had to do that for you, and you are not man enough to keep him. Again, your brother, you let him go. You've taken my son from me."
Gary sat unmoving. He saw nothing. He heard nothing. In his head was a soft, misty greyness, and the mist blotted out all sight and sound. It was warm in the mist, warm and safe. No one could reach him here, for it wrapped and protected him. He was safe.
"This is all you are good for?"
Anna snatched a handful of the manuscript sheets from the desk in front of him.
"Your little pieces of paper, your dreams and stories of other men, real men."
She ripped the pages through and through again, then flung them at him. The pieces fluttered and swirled, then settled like dead leaves on his shoulders and in his hair. He did not move. Panting in her grief and anger, she took up what remained of the manuscript and shredded that also, scattering the tiny white scraps about the room.